Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It seems like the threat of nuclear war is very far away, at least from the way I grew up with it. For example, how much did you hear about the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty? It's called the New START. The U.S. Senate still has to ratify the treaty, however, and the latest prediction is that it will take up the matter sometime during the lame duck session after the November elections. Joining us today to make a case for the treaty is Center for Arms Control Senior Military Fellow, Lieutenant General Robert Gard. Welcome back, General Gard.
Happy to be here.
And also former Strategic Command Deputy Commander, Lieutenant General Dirk Jameson. Welcome to the show, General Jameson.
Thank you very much.
According to a backgrounder on the Heritage Foundation's website today, the Obama administration is withholding negotiating records on the treaty, which the Senate has been privileged, has been privy to in the past as it deliberated whether to provide advice and consent on other treaties. What do you know about what the negotiating records are and the withholding of them?
Well, it's a detailed account of what went on over months of negotiations. And, of course, you want to be able to preserve those so you're not showing – you're not embarrassing the other side who may have made concessions to you and make it politically difficult for the other side. And you don't want to embarrass your own negotiators either if they – ran into some glitches along the way. And contrary to what the Heritage Foundation is asserting, it's very unusual to provide the negotiating record. And in fact, in this case, the administration has provided an extensive summary of the negotiating record pertaining to the missile defense issue, which is what the Heritage Foundation was raising.
The treaty, of course, is with Russia. It was signed in April. They've been working on it at least since last December when the last treaty expired. How much of it, from reading it, sounds like there's a lot of at least Cold War or remnants of Cold War rhetoric in that is how can we trust the Russians?
Well, of course, there is. As a former commander of the U.S. ICBM force back a few years, I'm very familiar with the processes and procedures that really make up the current arms control regimes. And, of course, you are moving from a Cold War structure to a new world structure, and that's a concern for many of the military people that I think General Gard and I represent. We are among an emerging consensus of former military people. Including, I might say, seven former commanders of the U.S. Strategic Command, the command that's responsible for the nuclear forces. And we're concerned that those processes and procedures, hard fought through negotiations over really decades and decades, will be somehow allowed to atrophy. As a matter of fact, the last treaty, the START One treaty, which was in effect for 15 years, expired December 5th, 2009. So for the last 8 months, we as a country have not had boots on the ground in Russia able to observe, monitor, critique, and report what's going on inside the Russian strategic forces. That's a very big concern and one that will grow over time. We definitely want to see the treaty ratified soon, because the longer we go without that information, the greater stress on stability, transparencies that we've won over many decades.
15-odd years ago when they were debating or considering the advice and consent process in the Senate, there wasn't politics involved then, because Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said recently that she regrets the debate has become political. Isn't everything political? Wasn't it political 16 years ago?
No, not really, because the overwhelming vote in the Senate in favor of all the previous arms control treaties, the so-called SORT treaty, the Moscow treaty that the previous administration introduced in the early part of this decade, passed 95-0. There have never been more than six votes against any of the arms control treaties. And I'm afraid Secretary Clinton is correct. At least up till now, the minority party in the Senate has made this a matter of political discipline in that Senator Kyle asked his colleagues not to take a position.
Right now, we understand that there are there's one minority senator in favor of the treaty announced and two that have announced that they will vote against it. And at this point in the process, there have been hundreds and hundreds of questions asked of experts like Henry Kissinger, like James Baker, like James Schlesinger, like George Shultz in hearings, and they've been answered chapter and verse, and it takes a lot of work to do that. And in our view, those issues have answered the questions quite well, and we would like to see movement on this treaty for the reasons I mentioned before. When you have a team of superstars that have been working for 15 years that know the inside and outside of the Russian strategic forces, and they speak Russian, and they have been involved in the negotiations, actually ask, how can we make the verification processes work better and more efficiently? And you put them on the sidelines for 8 months. They're like any other team. Even the Ohio State folks, if they didn't get to play football every year, they'd go somewhere else. And we're worried we're losing that expertise, and we need to get on with the ratification of this treaty.
Okay, so if they wait until the lame duck session and actually vote on it and it passes, is that good enough? Or worse yet, I suppose, in your opinion, what if they don't? What if they don't ratify it? What happens then?
It would be a disaster if the Senate did not vote their advice and consent so the treaty can be ratified. The entire non-proliferation arms control regime would probably collapse. Between us and the Russians, we have 95% of the world's nuclear weapons. There are clear indications that there's going to be a substantial expansion of power reactors, which means that nations with power reactors can either reprocess the spent fuel and produce plutonium, which you can make into a weapon, or if they enrich uranium as reactor fuel, all you have to do is continue the enrichment process up to about 90% concentrated as opposed to the 5% for fuel, and you make a weapon out of that. And the non-nuclear weapon states have put the nuclear weapon states on notice. If you don't get on with your responsibility to conduct negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to nuclear arms, to nuclear disarmament, we are not going to cooperate with you to prevent the expansion of the number of nuclear powers in the world, with all the dangers inherent in that.
My guests are Lieutenant General Robert Gard and Lieutenant General Dirk Jamieson, both from the Center for Arms Control, both senior fellows there. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Talking about the prospects for the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. It was signed in April by President Obama and the Russian President Medvedev. Thank you, producer Amy. Also talking about the fact that the U.S. Senate has not yet acted to consider their advice, to give their advice and consent in the treaty, which is must occur. Why? What is it about a treaty that requires the advice and consent of the U.S. Senate? Is it in the Constitution? Is it?
Yes, for it to become a treaty to which we have an obligation, it requires the Senate's advice and consent. The Senate doesn't ratify the treaty.
Right, okay.
It passes an advice and consent resolution authorizing the president to ratify the treaty.
Some Republicans have said that the New START would put significant limits on the U.S. missile defense. What are they talking about there?
Well, they have the opinion that in spite of the fact that the senior military people have testified that that is not true, that the administration has made it not true, that we understand that the Russians, who very much wanted commitments on missile defense, were told, if you insist on that, we will walk away from the treaty. So I don't believe that's true. I understand from the head of the Missile Defense Agency that that is not true. It's not in the treaty. It is in the – there is an association between offense and defense in the preamble to the treaty, which simply states the obvious, that there is a relationship between offense and defense. But as far as stipulations in the treaty that limit missile defense, it's simply not true.
Yeah, there's only one provision within the treaty itself. And that provision is that you cannot convert launchers that you use for strategic intercontinental ballistic missiles to missile defense interceptors. But as the head of Missile Defense Agency has said, why would we want to do that when it's more expensive to convert those launchers than it is to dig a new hole? And so we have no intention whatever of doing that. We do have five launchers at Vandenberg Air Force Base that were in fact converted to missile defense interceptors, but those are grandfathered in the treaty, so they're not subject to that restriction. But we have no desire to do that anyway.
Okay, we're going to have to take a break. When we return, we will continue our conversation with Lieutenant General Robert Gard and Lieutenant General Dirk Jameson, both fellows, the Center for Arms Control. We would welcome your questions and comments, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Join us at noon for Fresh Air. Jonathan Franzen made the cover of Time magazine in honor of his new novel, Freedom. The book got lots of advanced praise, but also quite a bit of negative reaction. On the next Fresh Air, a discussion about the backlash of making the cover of Time magazine and the art of publishing lengthy novels in the age of instant information. That's on Fresh Air at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 64 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:19. Sunshine today, a high of 73. Clear skies tonight, a low of 48 degrees. Sunshine for Friday, another nice day with a high of 75. There is a slight chance of rain on Saturday and a high of 80. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. My guests are Lieutenant General Robert Gard from the Center for Arms Control, where he is a senior military fellow, and also Lieutenant General Dirk Jameson. He's a former Strategic Command Deputy Commander. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I read several times now this is considered a particularly historical treaty. I would imagine, or historic treaty, I would imagine all of them are historic. What's special about this one?
Well, I think it continues the process, and the it follows the so-called reset with Russia, which I think is, and personally think that's very important. We need to be able to do business there. You ask before what would happen if this treaty weren't ratified, and I think that would be a very huge setback with our relationship with Russia. And again, 95% of the nuclear weapons are controlled by the U.S. and Russia. And for a lot of reasons, we need to see those numbers continue to go down. And the treaty is historic in the sense that there is a reduction from 6,000 weapons in START 1 down to 1,550 in the new START. And in terms of launchers, there's almost 50%, actually a 50% reduction there. Those are historic numbers. When you look back to the 1980s in the heart of the Cold War, we were talking tens of thousands. People might say, why is this nuclear discussion important now? And I think we should be upfront in acknowledging that really those huge numbers were way more than the world really needed to be at risk of. We're seeing progress there. And the new world, where the greatest threat, as talked about by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and many experts, is a terrorist action with a nuclear weapon. And that NPT, that nonproliferation regime that General Gard talked about, really works to put fences around that and draw in the control of those materials and weapons so that we don't have that risk going forward.
You know, of course, right now everybody's talking about the location, or except until, you know, the last few days, the location of an Islamic cultural center in Manhattan in the United States. Now it's about a proposed burning of a Quran in Florida. This treaty, however, although it has been covered and it's easy to find information about it, has not entered the national consciousness in the same way. And I'm wondering, we know that's the way it is in the United States, but what about around the world? How are others viewing this treaty? Is it something that people pay attention to anywhere?
Well, I think absolutely, and in particular, the non-nuclear weapon states, those that agreed not to acquire nuclear weapons, are fed up with the fact that the nuclear weapon states have not met their obligations to work in good faith toward nuclear disarmament. And if we were to reject this treaty, which admittedly does not destroy any warheads, it simply cuts down the number that are deployed. Nevertheless, that relates closely to the spirit of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and is considered by the president, in agreement with the president of Russia, whose name I can't pronounce either.
Thank you.
As being an absolutely essential step toward the next phase, which will address reduction of actual stockpiles of weapons and address tactical nuclear weapons, which have not been part of any of the treaties to date. So this is an absolutely essential step along the way.
It's been said that Senator George Voinovich of Ohio is considered a key political leader who could play an influential role in passing this treaty. How does that work? Why is that?
Well, as I mentioned before, we understand, first of all, it takes 67 votes in the Senate to ratify the treaty. And we understand right now that there are two minority senators that are opposed to the treaty, have announced that, and one minority senator that has said that he's going to vote for the treaty, that's Senator Lugar.
Right.
The rest are silent on the minority side. On the majority side, there's as far as has been announced, there are no votes against the treaty. So of the eight votes needed to go with the majority to get to the 67 votes, that means that each one of the senators is key, and Senator Voinovich would be absolutely key to that. He's seen as a moderate senator. He has asked and received answers to the questions, and they're good questions and good answers. And we would expect that a moderate senator, he's not running for re-election, would be stepping forward and doing what has been done in the past by the minority, and that is voting for arms control almost unanimously. Almost unanimously, with, you know, we're talking about two or three votes against all of the arms control treaties going back. So it's really unusual to be worried about getting seven votes out of the minority.
Well, and he, along with seven or so of his colleagues on the minority side, are not running for re-election. So one advantage in actually having the floor vote during a lame duck session is that they might feel less of an obligation to comply with party discipline should the party leadership of the minority elect to oppose the treaty for political reasons.
Okay, we have an email now from Paul. If you'd like to email us, we have a few more minutes. You can go to allsides@wosu.org. Paul writes, one aspect of warfare that seems to be missing from discussions is cyber warfare. The 2007 attack that crippled Estonia's systems was not conclusively linked to Russia. However, the issue of whether cyber attacks on military and critical infrastructure systems constitutes an act of war remains. What are the guests' observations on cyber attacks as they relate to treaties and international law?
Well, first of all, we know that cyber attacks are happening daily, and many of them are very substantial. And our national security apparatus has been taking major steps to prepare for that. There is the creation of a new cyber command. There is all kinds of effort to be able to handle the technologies required to blunt those attacks and to take action either on either side of the question, whether offensive or defensive. As to treaties, there is no treaty in that arena that I'm aware of. I'm sure that there are reasons to develop those kinds of things, and it's not related to the strategic nuclear question, but it's an important area that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, which we did not address as early as we should have.
What do you mean as early as?
Well, it's only very recently, I believe. Is that right, Dirk, that we have established a command to deal with this in a much more systematic way? The efforts have been somewhat decentralized and uncoordinated.
Okay. There's the issue of our domestic economic policy. How does that enter into the equation of our national security?
Well, it becomes a preoccupation with the American people because it affects them in their day-to-day lives. And that's why you see that as the principal concern. And, of course, something like the New START Treaty, which is very complicated and highly technical, unless you follow these issues, people just don't tend to focus on it because it would require a lot of time and effort to learn about the issues. There's not much learning to be done on the side of knowing you're out of a job and you need to provide for your family.
So what should voters, what should citizens of the United States do if this is an issue that they can't understand, they can't wrap their brain around it, it's too complex? How do they make a decision? How do they assert themselves in a democracy to make an intelligent decision?
One thing I would hope is that they would have some confidence and reason to listen to former military people that have been deeply involved in this, that have decades of experience, have interactions on arms control and interactions with the Russians, to say these are the reasons this is important. This is not a treaty without adequate verification to prove that we know that the Russians are abiding by a treaty that comes down in numbers. It reduces risk in terms of a possible attack in the future on our country, even though we're not enemies were looking to establish better relationships. And it just makes sense for the future that is really more about terrorist activities and the control of nuclear materials and weapons than it is about large numbers of offensive weapons. So this START treaty can be a bridge to that future. If we don't pass it, if we don't ratify it, it's going to be a terrible roadblock to our leadership with our relationship with the Russians and with the rest of the world. And the world is really looking for our leadership in that regard. So I hope, I pray that we will step up to that because our grandchildren really need a world that is more stable and with less risk, and we can move that direction.
There have been 70 former high-level government officials and experts in the nuclear era that have urged that this treaty be ratified. The Heritage Foundation's counteroffensive against the treaty has brought aboard 6 people. The 2 most prominent from the previous administration that was generally opposed to treaties because they feared it would limit the flexibility of the United States. The evidence is overwhelming. The endorsements of high-level officials from both parties is highly persuasive, and I would agree with Dirk where the electorate can't get into the details because of other concerns. They ought to give some credibility to the experts who have testified in favor of this.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you would like to speak with our experts in the studio today, Lieutenant General Robert Gard and also Lieutenant General Dirk Jameson, former Strategic Command Deputy Commander, and also both fellows at the Center for Arms Control. Do you think that the threat – well, I mentioned at the outset of the hour, it seems like the threat of nuclear war is very far away compared to the way it was when I was growing up. And in the 60s. And really, do you think there is a threat of nuclear war in our future?
I think the threat is greatly reduced. And I think that the reason is because we have worked on these treaties for a long period of time. This goes back to the Nixon administration when the numbers of warheads and weapon platforms were enormously more than they are today. So we were face to face with the Soviet Union, and we knew it was a competition that they intended to put us out of business. So it was so real. But the numbers just skyrocketed. It took a lot of effort to get a communication going over the Iron Curtain and get that underway. So now we've had decades and decades of experience of negotiating and moving down. And hopefully we can continue that with, you know, Reagan famously said, trust but verify. Some people, one of the complaints is we can't trust them. Mm-hmm. This treaty is not about trust. It's about people that are experts that are verifying with a very good regime for verification and assuring our side and assuring the Russians that we both are doing what we said we were going to do, and it's for a safer world. This is really kind of a no-brainer.
Yes, the threat, as the president said, the threat of global nuclear war, that is an exchange that could destroy civilization between the U.S. and the then Soviet Union, is vastly reduced. But he said correctly, the threat of a nuclear attack has increased because now we have a new dimension. That is, terrorists who have vowed to obtain a nuclear weapon. There's a fatwa to kill 4 million Americans, 2 million of them children, in retaliation for what is perceived by the extremists as the United States and our client, the Zionists, having killed and used violence against Muslims.
that's out there. That's it. So if they get their hands on the right weapons.
Or the right materials to fashion a weapon. Mm-hmm. If they can get 55 pounds of highly enriched uranium, it's no trick to configure a nuclear explosive device from that. You just have to look on the internet, and you can buy all the equipment in some of the big hardware stores.
You know, they're talking about trying to reestablish some kind of connection with North Korea right now just to start talks on anything. How does a country like North Korea look upon the status of the START right now? What might they be deducing or thinking about when they see the inaction by the U.S. Senate?
Well, I'm not sure anybody knows what goes on inside the minds of the North Koreans, and this week is particularly germane when we talk about succession and those kinds of things.
Right.
I think they do ascribe an importance to our power, not just nuclear, but conventional. We are a very powerful nation. I think they want to be seen as a nation that has to be reckoned with. So that's why they assert that their nuclear weapon or two or three has changed the equation. And in fact, we do pay attention to them for that reason. And I would only say that in terms of the treaty, I would doubt that that's very high on their radar screen. But if it falls short, I think they might really say, "What's going on here? You know, how can we take advantage of that?" I'm sure that would be a calculation.
Right, the treaty itself not very important. The lack of a treaty
yes.
maybe becomes of more interest to them. I want to thank my guest today, former Strategic Command Deputy Commander Lieutenant General Dirk Jameson, and also welcome back and thanks for coming again to. Center for Arms Control Senior Military Fellow, Lieutenant General Robert Gard. I appreciate you being with us today. Talk about this.
Thank you so much.
And before we move on to another topic, I want to remind our listeners that we're still looking for that listener advisory board. If you are interested in it, we are interested in your opinion. So go to WOSU.org/survey and let us know what you think. It's a very short survey, and there's no obligation involved. Coming up, we're going to talk about the plans to burn the Quran in Florida and get some feedback from local Muslim leaders and also from some people in Washington. Hope you'll stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Freedom, landed him on the cover of Time magazine last month. In the Sunday New York Times Book Review, Sam Tannenhaus wrote, "Franzen's new novel, like his previous one, The Corrections, is a masterpiece of American fiction." On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Franzen reads from and talks about freedom. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Hear more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Signs with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archive shows from all the guests and topics, podcast All Sides, at WOSU.org/All Sides. And at WOSU, listener feedback is very important. We'd like to hear your thoughts on our radio programming. Just visit WOSU.org/survey, and there you can sign up and send us your thoughts.
Support for WOSU comes from Thurber House, presenting Evenings with Authors guest, Indian journalist and author Thriti Umrigar, reading from her novel The Weight of Heaven, this Friday evening at the Columbus Performing Arts Center. Tickets at ThurberHouse.org.
64 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40. Sunshine today and a high of 73. Clear skies tonight and a low of 48. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're switching gears now. We're going to talk about the plans to burn the Quran in at a church in Florida, a very small church, just 50 members, but it's attracted the attention of millions and millions of Americans. People are talking about it all over the place. It's kind of eclipsed the discussion about the Islamic Cultural Center in Manhattan, in a way. In fact, some people don't even remember that that's what it's all about. So rejoining us today, are two folks, Harris Terran. He's with the Muslim Public Affairs Council in Washington, D.C., where he's the director. Welcome back, Harris.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
And also, Abdinur Muhammad. He is a member of the local Muslim community and an educator. Welcome back, Abby.
Thank you, Glenn.
We are going to be joined in a few minutes by an organizer at the First Unitarian Universalist Church in Clintonville, where they're gathering on Saturday for a Burn No Sacred Book service. We'll hear from he's on the air right now. Well, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. This is Ray Nandiel from First Unitarian Universalist Church in Clintonville, like Ann said. We are organizing an interfaith solidarity service on September 11th at 2 o'clock, and we will be joined by clergy from various faiths, including Islam and Catholicism and Judaism, and we are gathering to commemorate 9/11 as well as express solidarity with our Muslim friends of faith who are being targeted by hate campaigns, including the crazy call by a Florida pastor to burn the Quran.
Let's hear from President Obama. He says Terry Jones's plan to do that is, quote, contrary to our values as Americans.
I just want him to understand that this stunt that he is talking about pulling could greatly endanger our young men and women in uniform who are in Iraq, who are in Afghanistan. We're already seeing protests against Americans just by the mere threat.
What do you say to that as far as the contrary to our values, Ray?
Columbus, Ohio especially is a very diverse community. We believe in pluralism and religious tolerance, and that's how we haven't had any incidents of disturbance. And so we would like to keep it that way, and we need to learn how to live in a pluralistic society without saying my book is better than yours. So that's why we have wonderful messages from various community leaders for this event. Senator Sherrod Brown will send a representative or send a message, and also Rabbi Apotheker, Rabbi Berman, and ministers from UCC, Disciples of Christ, lots of folks who send their good wishes for our community harmony.
Is Abdinur, is that your sense about Central Ohio, that it's pretty peaceful here and there isn't the movement afoot to encourage this kind of thing?
Absolutely, and as a matter of fact, last Saturday, the Council on American Islamic Relations held an iftar, breaking of the fast, at OSU Student Union, where members of the community participated, shared information about Islam, and the interfaith community was present there, as well as members of the community at large. So Columbus is, by and large, a peaceful a community, and we're proud of the kind of community we have here.
Let's hear from President Obama again. He says he's worried that burning a Quran in Florida will have much larger ramifications.
This is a recruitment bonanza for al-Qaeda. You could have serious violence in places like Pakistan or Afghanistan. This could increase the recruitment of individuals who'd be willing to blow themselves up in American cities or European cities.
Harris Terran, what's your sense about that now? I mean, what are you hearing?
I think, Anne, the first thing that we have to take into consideration is that General Petraeus mentioned this even before the president talked about it. And General Petraeus generally has a very good sense of the feelings and the pulse on the ground. You know, he's done a great job in Iraq, and currently now has taken command in Afghanistan. And he constantly engages local officials, local folks, to ensure that the jobs, the work that our troops are doing on the ground, is supported by the values that we hold dear to as Americans. And I think General Petraeus, when he mentioned that that this will have a negative effect on the work that our troops are doing on the ground, that's spot on. Because on a daily basis, our troops are putting their lives at risk to stand up for the same values that this minister or this pastor is trying to promote in terms of his ugliness. And I think that's an affront to the work of our troops on the ground. And also the fact that I think we also have to realize that, as President Obama said, this was a stunt. This was really a stunt by an individual who was a congregation of no more than 50 people who was trying to seek attention. And unfortunately, he got that attention. And that what we have to do is to ensure that around the Muslim majority countries around the world, they know that this is not the real America. That this is not the sentiments and the feelings of the majority of Americans around this country, and that the majority of Americans, like in Ohio and everywhere else in this country, they're coming together to ensure that people hear the true message of the of our American values. And I think it's been unfortunate that he's gotten this attention, but I think there's something good that can come out of this, and that is the real values of Americans all across this nation.
You know, I don't remember anybody suggesting burning a Quran before 9/11, but some folks are asking, do we have to live like this forever? You know, they want to know, do we have to live in fear like this forever every time you do something to offend somebody from another religion, in this case, Muslim religion? Do we have to worry about this kind of retaliation?
You know, that is unfortunate, but the problem here is that our troops are at war. They're at war in two different countries. And so I don't think the issue is really a retaliation in our cities or people going over the edge. I know the Muslim American community, that's not an issue that we have. Muslim Americans are extremely used to living in a pluralistic society, and understand that there are nuances in living in a pluralistic society, and that they definitely will face people who don't necessarily agree with the ideas and their values and their book. But I think the issue that the president was talking about and General Petraeus was talking about is the fact that our troops are at war with two countries who have majority Muslim populations. And in those countries, there are sentiments and feelings that when something like this happens, it's not only a crazy pastor in a small town who's doing this, but they have a feeling through international media, through satellite channels, that this is a war on their religion and their identity. So I think that nuance needs to be taken into consideration, that our troops are fighting on a daily basis in two countries that have majority Muslim population.
Abdener?
Yes, I agree with what Mr. Tieran has said, but I would like to also add that for the past 9 years, the leadership of the United States, President Bush, President Obama, and others have been saying that America is not at war with Islam, that it is a small group of people that have attacked us on 9/11. And burning the Quran changed that whole debate, that people would think this it's about Islam and not about this small group of people. And as Mr. Tieran said, this is a small church with less than 50 people, but their voice is now heard throughout the world. And 300 million Americans are not represented by this group of people, and we need to speak out loud. American Muslims understand that Pastor Terry Jones has the First Amendment right to do what he's trying to do, but it's the wrong thing to do. It attracts negative attention to the United States. America is seen in the world as a leader in the free world. Muslims and other people of faith came to America looking for freedom of religion. And the message that this act will send will be a counter to that work that has been done for the past 8 years or 9 years.
614-292-8513 if you want to join the conversation. Scott, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. And thanks for having the conversation.
You bet.
Enjoying it. It goes right to the heart of my question, at least the first one, which was how come this isn't being viewed as a First Amendment right, much as that famous artwork of Piss Christ and the elephant dung Madonna, as far as those were First Amendment, those were free speech issues. And this, of course, is presented, that argument is completely ignored. Also, I would ask, I've heard it brought up twice now, that everyone's concerned about the safety of the troops. But really, my question about that would be, what have you guys actively done to help our country obtain victory in Iraq and Afghanistan, not just, you know, preventing us from or preventing some nut job in Florida from burning Korans? But what have you guys actively done to help this country, to help our country obtain victory in Iraq and Afghanistan?
What do you mean by what are you guys? When you say you guys, who are you talking about?
Everybody that's on the radio. And I've listened to your program ever since you took over from Fred, and I must say I enjoy it. I've heard you bring on plenty of folks that have talked about, how this is an illegal war, about all the supposed atrocities that we're committing and what a negative effect that this has had on our image as a country, much like the Koran burning is currently having.
Mm-hmm.
But what have you guys actively done to help us win the war?
And can I answer?
Sure. Harris Tieren? Yeah. We'll let Harris Tieren respond then. Thanks, sure. Scott. Hang on.
Sure. Basically, what Scott needs to be aware of is what both President Bush and President Obama pointed out. Ultimately, these two wars that we have are not wars with weapons, but rather wars to win the hearts of Muslims in both these countries. And we can only do that by behaving ourselves. And we can use our First Amendment rights to misbehave, but that's not going to help us win, you know, the hearts and minds. There's no way we can have a $10 trillion budget. Will we win if we don't win the hearts and minds of people there?
And I think to add to that, nobody's questioning the First Amendment rights of this individual to do what he is seeking to do. That's why nobody's going to arrest him. No government official can take any action to stop him. And I think Mayor Bloomberg put it very astutely when he said it's distasteful, but it's protected. He has a constitutional right to do what he's doing. And I think nobody questions that. So that's the first question. The second question as to what we are doing in terms of ensuring that that our country comes out victorious, I think that's a great question. In terms of the Muslim American community, the Muslim American community is on the front lines of fighting this battle against extremism and radical violent extremism. In our mosques, in our communities, our scholars, our leaders on a daily basis are engaged in this conversation with those individuals who seek to cause harm to our country, to ensure that they do not become part of the mainstream discourse and that their narrative does not become part of the mainstream. So on that level, the Muslim American community, since 9/11, has been extremely involved and has been on the front lines of protecting our institutions and our country. There's been Muslim American soldiers who have given their lives in both Iraq and Afghanistan alongside their fellow citizens. So I think that is an extremely important point to take into consideration, is that the Muslim American community has been a part and parcel of every component of this society. And whether we agree if a war was legal or not, or if the war was ethical or not, we continue to ensure that our country is safe and protected, and that institutions are protected, both domestically and abroad.
Yeah, also, if I could add, Scott, this is not just about objecting to what Pastor Terry Jones is doing. On a positive side, this is also making sure that we create a community filled with peace and harmony and avoid segregation of all kinds. We've had a history of segregation, and we need to, you know, as much as possible, build bridges. So if I could just, you know, reverse your question, I hope you are doing something to avoid psychological civil wars in our own communities. I hope you will be there at this event in Columbus to see people of different religions mixing together and creating a harmonious community. And we would love to have you, and I would love to talk to you in person, too.
Okay. Thank you, Ray Nandiel. He's from the First Unitarian Universalist Church in Clintonville. They're having an event on Saturday night, Saturday afternoon for a Burn No Sacred Book service. So if you want more information about that, we'll post their web address on our website, wosu.org/allsides. And Obdener, did you want to say something?
Yeah, and I would like to just highlight the fact that the First Amendment right is something that is clearly understood by Americans and Muslim Americans here in this country. But people in other parts of the world do not understand why people have that kind of right. And it has been the responsibility of Muslim Americans in contact with their folks abroad to explain to them the rights that we have in this country and the fact that what this man is doing has is acceptable within the law in this country. But people in Pakistan and India and Somalia and other places do not really understand why an individual would take sacred books and burn them in public, be that Christian books or Islamic books or Judaism books. So the point here is that we play a role in explaining to our own folk here and abroad that some of these acts, even though they are reprehensible, are freedoms that are provided to Americans here in this country. And the role that many Americans can play is to give the other perspective that not all Americans behave this way, that we respect the sacred books of other faiths, and that we do not go about burning books just to attract attention.
Harris Tiran, do we just wait now?
I think, you know, The interesting thing is that this pastor has given himself a little bit of room. He continues to say that we're praying, and I think that shows the nature of what this stunt was all about, is to attract attention to him and to his really ambitious stunt to gain attention nationally and internationally. And this is not the first time he's done something like this. His former congregation has called him out for being an individual who was very insensitive to the congregation and that did not mean well. So, unfortunately, this he's been able to contrive this controversy, and we're going to have to wait until Saturday. And the sad thing about all of this is Saturday, 9/11, was meant to mourn the lives of 3,000 of our fellow citizens who died 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to have to listen to this pastor, this individual who's in the remote part of the country, actually make a decision. And rather than focusing our attention on mourning and healing, we're going to be focused on trying to figure out what this pastor is doing.
Okay, I want to say thanks to Harris Tiran, Director of the Muslim Public Affairs Council in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us again, Harris.
Thank you for having me.
And also Obdener Mohammed. He is an educator and a member of the local Muslim community. Obdener, thanks for being here again.
Thank you, Anne.
And also thanks to Ray Nandiel of the First Unitarian Universalist Church in Clintonville. They have a program set for September 11th at 2 p.m., a Burn No Sacred Book service. We'll learn more about that on our website. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.